Well, the first half is going to be sort of introductory, because I guess yesterday in the solid state part, or the equation of state part, I could have used a bit more introductory material to help me understand what was going on. So, and the second part, the middle part, I'm going to be describing what's currently being done in the field. And the last part, I'm going to be talking about some work I'm currently doing and still very much in the stages of thinking about. So what I'll be talking about is searches for substellar objects. I'm not going to talk about which are... Can you just leave it on? Yeah. I'm not going to make a distinction or go into the distinction between planets and brown dwarfs. I just call them substellar for my purposes. I'm interested in these low mass things and how they form. So that's the point of view I'm going to take, is trying to get an idea of how they form. People who are doing optical and near-infrared searches are having a great deal of success at finding substellar candidates, and doing follow-up work that suggests they really do have low masses, down to about 10 Jupiter masses in star-forming regions. And this is an interesting mass limit. It sort of starts to probe the mass regime, a transition between what we might think of as giant planets or brown dwarfs. So I'll talk about that in a bit more detail. I won't put this up. The extrasolar planets, the radial velocity searches, I'm just going to mention in passing. Hopefully somebody will talk about it later, but I don't know enough about it to really give you a good summary. But some things that have come out of that are that the extrasolar planets that are being detected are fairly massive, you know, more or less Jupiter mass, and they have highly eccentric orbits. They're not circular orbits. They're very elliptical. And that's something that we have to account for in the theories. So the standard theory of planet formation starts with a low-mass disk. Some of you in the audience can just do something else for a little bit. Where you start bottom up, you start with roughly a 10 Jupiter mass disk or so, maybe a bit bigger, a bit smaller. Dust in the disk, interstellar dust, slowly grows in size through various processes. At some point, you form a core able to attract the gas in the disk and form a gas giant planet. So this is a theory that's been worked on for a long time. And some aspects of it are that because you form in a disk, you get circular orbits. And a feature of the theory is that the disk is colder in the outer regions. You get ices that form. It's easier to form the larger planets, the gas giant planets. But this theory has some difficulties, some greater than others. I'll just go through them. One is that it takes too long to form these rocky cores before you need to accrete the mass. Observations have suggested that the gas goes away by 10 million years. I guess I heard there was a recent Nature paper that said there is some evidence for the gas still being around, molecular hydrogen. I haven't seen it, so I don't have anything to say about it. It's something maybe will come up later.
But 10 to the 8 years is the theories of Pollack et al. It's more 10 to the 7 years is more realistic, more representative of what they get.
Okay, so you would say 10 to the 7 years for that time scale.
It depends on the surface density.
Well, it does depend on the surface density. So.
The model can give 10 to the 8, but it could also give 10 to the 7.
Yeah. Okay, well, these, you change the surface density in the disk and you can form different mass cores. One thing, I don't know if this has been solved, but difficulty with the modeling is that it seems to be hard to form something that's more massive than Jupiter. And objects more massive than Jupiter are certainly observed. So it seems to take unrealistically high surface densities to form something
that depends on tidal truncation. The issue is not whether you have enough mass around. You do have enough mass around in typical disk models. But in the models that you may have seen in the literature, people assume that at some point, the angular momentum transfer between the planet and the disk opens a gap. They tweak the numbers so as to get one Jupiter mass. But the fact is, we don't know enough about the propagation aspects and dissipation of waves in the disk to say that it has to be one Jupiter mass rather than 10 or 20.
Yeah, and actually now the hydro simulations show that even if you have a gap, you still have accretion from the planet. So it's more having the gas in the nebula accreted by the star at the same time as it's accreted
on the planet. That's the other thing that's happening. You've got a net radial flow as well. Okay.
Well, maybe there are ways around these difficulties. When I saw Peter Bodenheimer discuss his models, the only way he had to make the massive planets was by increasing the surface density. But given the uncertainty and the gap that you open up and how you transfer mass, maybe that's still a very open issue, perhaps.
That's correct. It's an open issue as to whether it could work or not. But most of the literature is motivated by understanding our solar system. And if you go through it and say, you know, can I fiddle this number? Can I fiddle that number? And you add all those fiddles, you can get down to anything you like.
And this is the most well-developed theory, so. So it tends to form the gas giants in the outer solar system, and there are many extrasolar planets observed at much smaller distances from the star. Although it's been suggested that there's a tidal migration, maybe this is not a serious problem. And it makes circular orbits. That's possibly okay too, because you can have the system evolve in time through gravitational interactions between the various planets, and the systems tend to be very unstable. So it actually seems like it might be easy to increase the eccentricity. So maybe there are ways around all these things. I'm not an expert on this theory, clearly, but I wanted to talk about it in contrast to how we think stars form. And the advantages of this theory are it explains our solar system, which is good, and it forms gas giants that are metal enriched. That's, I guess, a difference from other formation theories for forming giant planets. Now, how do stars form? Well, I'm going to go through these very different scenarios and then mix them up at the end. So you start out with a molecular cloud, which is low density, and you have pieces of the cloud that get denser, that regions of the cloud that get much denser, more massive, that form slowly out of the cloud, eventually become gravitationally unstable and collapse. And you quickly, actually can't really see this phase, but you quickly set up the system where you have a star-like object in the center, a disk around it, and material from the cloud collapsing into the central regions, and a vigorous bipolar wind from the system. And this is most of the protostar phase, that you have material collapsing into the disk, going onto the star, some of it coming out in the wind, most of it going into the star. And during this phase, you have conservation of angular momentum during the collapse. Because you conserve angular momentum, there's a lot of it, and it tends to go into the orbits of the things that form. So in the case, you often form binary star system, and most of the angular momentum is in the orbit. When you get rid of all the gas and dust by whatever means, you end up with a visible star, pre-main sequence star, surrounded by a disk, and those objects might be like a million years old instead of a few by 10 to 5 years old.
Excuse me, is the word quiescent up there important for us, in the business? What does it mean?
This is a way to form single stars. Yes, it's important.
What is a
non-quiescent star? It's a formation of stars, and you're supposed to think of these parts of the cloud as being sort of quiet, well-behaved places.
But actually, you are asking an important question in the following sense. We have reason to believe that our solar system might be a little bit unusual, and it comes from the short-lived radioisotopes, which suggests that the system formed very quickly, and the particular mix of those isotopes also suggests to some people that a supernova was involved. And so an idea that's been around for decades has been revived in recent years, where our solar system was triggered by a supernova, a nearby supernova, which then triggered, promoted the collapse, and also injected these particular radioisotopes that we see showing up, like aluminum-26, which has a half-life less than a million years, which we see actually in meteorites. So the meteorite record is where this information comes from.
Yeah, but apparently from very recent geochemical analysis of some meteorites, they found other trace species that you cannot explain with a supernova. So it's a group, François Robert and Chaussidon in there, being published, I don't know which review, but in the past 2 months or something like that. And apparently the supernova explanation is not required anymore. So, which is better, because it would be a very strange chance that, okay, you would need the supernova then, and then not another supernova later. And the probability to have that is much more so.
Well, okay, I don't know that word, but let me just make one more comment. Whatever happened, it happened fast. That's what the meteorite is telling us.
But to answer Neil's question, I think in this context, quiescent means that the relevant information type is the speed of sound, basically the adiabatic speed of sound. Whereas in a non-quiescent formation, you may have turbulence, which means speed of sound and shock waves and all that, which means that information is going to propagate much faster than with the standard speed of sound.
That's right. In more turbulent areas, you have magnetic fields, and you have to take into account magnetic pressure, and it's not simply the thermal sound speed. So I wasn't really going to go into all that for this audience, but it's just these are sort of cold places. The thermal sound speed describes very well what gas pressure support there is, and it's a balance between gas pressure and gravity. Those are the important physics going on. So in this theory, at least from the properties of the cloud that you start out with, and the fact that we know initial temperatures and densities and things, and the fact that angular momentum is conserved, you can predict what the size of the disk is that you're going to form. And if you put in kind of typical numbers, like a solar mass of gas, if you're trying to form a solar mass star in a typical rotation rate for the cloud that you start out with, then depending on the slight differences in the temperature of the initial cloud from 10 degrees to 30 degrees Kelvin, you form disks of various sizes of half an AU to 50 AU. So, you can form disks of roughly solar system dimensions just from knowing the properties of the initial gas cloud. So what do these kinds of star formation studies tell us that's relevant to planet formation. Well, this is just not so relevant to planet formation, but most stars have bipolar wind, and most stars form in binary systems that are not single stars. And most stars have circumstellar disks, where a typical mass might be about 0.01 solar masses to within a factor of a few, which is a very typical mass. It's similar to what we'd expect in the early solar system. And the sizes that you can measure are roughly solar system dimensions. Some are much bigger, some are much smaller, but 100 AU isn't too far off. Something that's been coming out of more recent calculations are how to form binaries, because that's one thing that hasn't been understood very well, I think. It doesn't come naturally out of the standard collapse theory, but most stars are in binary systems, and you find that observed binary systems, the typical separation is about 40 AU. It has a wide range of scales down to stars that touch out to thousands of AU, but this is pretty typical. How do we form binaries? Well, one idea, and I think that's easy to understand but seems to not be right from the numerical simulations, is fragmentation of the cloud and collapsing to form binaries. This doesn't seem to work, that if you start out with a cloud that's slightly clumpy and you have roughly mass in each clump that's going to form your final star, half a solar mass or one solar mass, you start out something with a typical scale of 10,000 AU. When you collapse this thing, you end up with a very wide binary, like 1,000 AU. So you can form wide binaries this way, but you can't form more typical binaries. So the current thinking on binary formation is that rather that you start with multiple seeds, sort of tiny, small mass, point masses, multiple ones that form, you know, down in the center of the potential well and close together. And these accrete material throughout time as the cloud collapses. And this is a little circumbinary disk that goes around the two. And I'd say there's still a lot of unresolved issues about how to form binary systems, but the people who do this work all seem to agree about this point, that fragmentation of the initial cloud is not how it's done. Something more along these lines is the right picture. So we're looking at, or I'm looking for the very lowest mass things that are star-like or in star-forming regions. And how might you form them? Well, they might form in a way that's similar to the way stars formed. And I just outlined the process. You can imagine just scaling everything down. You start out with lower mass core, smaller core, and sort of imagine the process going on in a similar way. There are theories that they were mentioned. Most recently, Alan Boss has done a bunch of work on this, that you form a disk and that you form condensations directly out of the disk that are have roughly the size of gas giant planets. These would tend to be, you'd form an isolated object if you formed it in a way similar to a star. This would form in a disk, or you might form them the way with the standard theory. But there are a lot of stability calculations now that suggest that that these early systems are not terribly stable. So I guess it's a question of whether this dynamical instability important to form isolated objects. I mean, are they possibly ejected from their systems? They form in a disk around a star, and are they thrown out of the system? But you'd tend to have this happen in a binary system, for example. And there are a couple of papers, one by Sturzik and Durasin, where they're looking at star formation. They start out saying, well, you start out with 3 or 4 or 5 star-like objects. You let them interact with each other. What happens? Do you form the right number of binary systems, the right number of triple systems, things like that? And they find that, indeed, that these systems tend to decay to binary system, and they tend to eject the lowest mass object in the system. Looking at stability more from the point of view of disks, there's one paper that's relevant is Levison et al., that they start out with a gaseous disk, they sprinkle it with planets, more terrestrial-sized planets, and see what happens, and they find many of the planets are swallowed by the star, some modest fraction are ejected from the system, like 10 or 20%. So this is where these theories start to get mixed up, if these dynamical instability or gravitational instability is important. You potentially form planets around a star, but they don't stay there. You might find them a population of isolated objects. We've seen this before. I just want to make the point again that this is Adam Burrows, I hope he's in here somewhere. Luminosity or brightness versus time. This is a million years, sort of the age of the regions that I'm looking at, and a billion years over here for typical ages of stars now. And you can see that, well, the point I want to make is things are brightest when they're youngest. Okay, when they form, they have a lot of, that there's a lot of gravitational energy that's released. And so they are very bright. So if you want to detect them, you have a good chance of finding them in star-forming regions when they're relatively bright and relatively hot. So some of the work that's being done, this is, I'm going to talk about a few regions that are relatively young star-forming regions that where people have been looking for things. One of the nearest is the TW Hydra Association. It's not very big. It's got a few tens of stars, and it's sort of a little older than most of the things that regions I've worked on, typical star-forming regions, about 10 million years. And but its favor, it's pretty close by, 55 parsecs, which is an advantage in trying to find faint things. So here, as an example, is TWA-5b, which was found as looking for faint objects next to brighter objects in the cluster and trying to show that they're associated. Common proper motion, they move together through the sky. For a cloud this close, proper motion is significant. So you can show association by seeing that things track together in the sky. And looking at the spectral type and seeing that it's has the expected effective temperature for this 10 million year old age. And indeed, it has about the right temperature you'd expect for a low mass object, and you get masses out that are about 20 to 30 Jupiter masses. Did I actually start at 9? So people are finding such objects, some studying in details, getting their brightness and temperature and comparing them with models. Here's an example of just getting the masses out from the models and plotting the number of them versus mass. Since you're looking at young things, you get a measure of the initial mass function, which is just how many there are in different mass bins, you tend to form a lot more low-mass objects than high-mass objects. And in this case, it's a comparison of two different regions, the Taurus cloud and the Rho-Ulf cloud. And I say, well, Taurus, for some reason, just doesn't have very many of these 10 to 30 Jupiter mass objects. This is actually 0.1 solar masses here. Whereas Rho-Ulf does, and people are collecting more and more data. This is pretty typical. It's a color magnitude diagram where this is a proxy for luminosity of brightness, and this is scales with temperature. And in these regions, you also have to worry about the dust, which tends to preferentially extinct the light from these objects. So the low mass objects might be here for a particular age, high mass up there. The dust will take them from this line and move them here, depending how much dust is in the way. So this region in Orion, you see they have a lot of candidates down at pretty low masses. These are the ones that at the time he had follow-up spectroscopy for to actually measure the temperatures of these objects.
I'm always a little bit skeptical about how do you define the reddening in such a young cluster. I mean, you assume the reddening is homogeneous through the cloud, because it's very important. It's very kind of magnitude today. Get my point? I mean, there's a lot of dust in these guys.
There's a lot of dust,
And there is no reason, I'd say, for the extinction function to be homogeneous through the cloud.
No, you don't need it to be the same everywhere.
But you need...
You need the dust to... In order to actually calculate numbers, you need the dust to be more or less the same composition and properties everywhere. That's right. So this is... Those lines are drawn for standard dust.
That's an important issue. I'm not convinced that the extension is really well known in any other cluster.
In the near infrared, it's a lot better behaved than in optical wavelengths.
Yeah.
But it's true, if you don't know the slope of this quite right, you will de-redden this and make a mistake in what the intrinsic brightness
and
is.
And a little bit of magnitude makes a whole lot of difference in the mass, and vice versa. I mean, a small amount of mass is a few magnitude. So, I mean, just to mention, I'm always a bit skeptical about cutoffs in the IM clusters.
But people that work in the near infrared, you have less extinction there, and you're working with much smaller corrections to the brightness. Because at 2 microns, the extinction is 10 times less than at optical wavelengths. So it tends to be a modest correction to the brightness compared with optical wavelengths.
Yeah, but practically, it means that if you don't have the same amount of dust everywhere, the size of the arrows will change depending on what, not the slope, but the size of the arrow will change depending on what star you're looking at.
I mean, change in two dimensions. Even in 3 minutes.
I don't understand the point about the size of the error changing.
The reddening is not going to be uniform across the region, is what they're bringing in.
Right, but you measure that.
Yeah.
You measure multiple wavelengths, so you actually measure what the reddening is. You don't have to assume what
it is. Sure, once you have a spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, not from the colors alone. You wouldn't trust that this one color magnitude then.
You cannot get it from photometry, you need spectroscopy. And you need to know the synthetic spectrum you want to compare the data to.
People do that. They do get spectra. They do classify objects.
Anyway.
If you do photometry through filters, you can estimate the reddening.
You can estimate the reddening that they're saying you don't know the intrinsic color. In the near infrared, the intrinsic color difference for normal stars down to about mid-M is very small, 0.3 roughly. So, and that's small compared with the reddening. So it's just, that's a modest uncertainty as well. So Maria Rosa is speaking after me, and since I've done all the introduction, she'll get to tell you mostly about her stuff. I guess one point from previous studies is that you can measure the initial mass function. This is plotted backwards, unfortunately, but the low mass, the brown dwarfs, low mass objects are all over here, and a number of different groups have been getting slopes in the number in equal mass intervals. That goes roughly about m to the 0.6. So it's not quite flat, but still it's not dropping off precipitously, and you do have a fair population of very low mass objects down to 20, 30 Jupiter masses or so. And people are pushing those limits down all the time. So I'm just going to briefly show you what I've been up to. We've been with a few other people, Dave Van Buren, Tom Jarrett, and Nick Godier. We wanted to understand how these low mass objects form. And the idea was to design a survey that would preferentially find the lowest mass things. And so we're looking at in the optical at the most opaque piece of sky that we can find, because we want to find everything that's in the surface of the cloud. We want to find the faintest objects we can and sort of screen out all the background stuff to the extent that we can, and just efficiently pick out anything that's in the surface of the cloud. And this is the Rho Ulf cloud. It's young, about 1 million years, and relatively nearby, one of the closest classical star-forming regions. So I'll just show you my pretty slides, since I have a few. Did it turn itself off? Did someone turn it off? Okay.
Just to interject a general comment for non-astronomers in the audience, what Sue is telling us about here are objects where we don't know their masses, except to the extent that we think we know the age of the system and the expected luminosity for a given mass. So it's really coming from luminosity. Now, of course, what is of great importance for understanding the initial condition, if you will, for evolution, which includes the high-pressure physics that many of you are interested in, is knowing the mass and actually testing the luminosity. And we will get to that in later talks, but I just want you to realize that when Sue talks about a particular mass, or when Maria talks about a particular mass, in most cases they don't really know the mass. They're only estimating that it's a certain number of Jupiter masses on the basis of a belief in a theoretical model of the kind that Adam Burrows creates. And Adam, of course, will be talking later.
Okay, but to the extent that we're able to test these models, there does seem to be a reasonable correspondence between objects people are finding and what the properties of the models predict.
Yeah.
Although nobody would trust the models below 1 million years of age. That's true. So this is long wavelength data that shows you where the dust is. So, and these green circles are three optical fields, I-band fields. So this in particular picks out the very densest parts of these star-forming regions, shows you where all the material is. And this is that's in a molecular line, CES. This, I don't have the circles, but it's roughly this is 1 millimeter dust picture, and it's roughly the same size as the optical regions we surveyed you can see it picks out the very highest extinction regions where there's the most dust. This is a 2-micron picture. We use the 2-micron data from the 2-micron all sky survey. So here are fields I'm going to, and we, if I have time, mention both of these, but you can see there's a sprinkling of objects in here at 2 microns in the optical. We lose a lot of them because the dust blocks the light. We see far fewer. So here's.
Can you put these circles in there?
What's that?
What defines the location of the circles?
The circles are the approximate sizes of our optical fields. And I'm just putting them on top of data at a different wavelength. So you can see this region at different wavelengths. So this is some of our data, and most of these things are young stars or protostars in the cloud, but in the very surface of the cloud. You see these are, again, young. There's a lot of scattered light from starlight that's scattered off the dust. So we take data, like this is one field. It was using the Palomar 5-meter telescope, going as deep as we could. Here's our second field. You can see the stars a bit better in that. And we process it to take out the background, the uneven background of the cloud. So we're left with just the stars in these regions. And then we get to one of these color magnitude diagrams. We have optical data at I band. It's about 8,000 or 0.8 microns. But what we actually do is here is plot, find the corresponding near infrared magnitudes at 2 microns, and H and K are 1.6 and 2 microns. I don't really have time, I guess, to explain this diagram, but it's similar to the others. You're looking for faint objects, comparing them with these models, trying to get spectra, to get temperatures. We've got objects on here. We have candidates we determine from the optical, a modest number of them that we don't have near-infrared data for, so couldn't plot them on here. But this is roughly the regime that we'd be trying to find these 5 to 20 Jupiter mass ones. I've been staring at this diagram a lot. I've got another one with more of our data in it.
What's the age of the...
It's been variously given as 1 million years or 1/3 of that, 3 × 10⁵ years. Theoreticians are not willing to publish models at such young ages, so it's a bit difficult to get the right model to estimate an age. But this is very young, probably one of the youngest star-forming regions known.
Very young means older or younger than 1 million years old?
No older than 1 million years, and probably less.
Probably less.
So it means that at that scale, the stars were not formed at the same time. I mean, on a time scale of 1 million years, you have some stars have formed 1 million years ago, yeah. And some formed just a few 100,000 years ago.
But it's a bit what you see. I mean, these are. Isochrones, and so if you try to, I mean, it looks like it fits a few isochrones. So I'm trying to figure out because I see 10^6 and 10^8.
This would be 10^8 would be a relevant isochrone for foreground or background stars, old objects,
uh-huh.
And you'd have to for this particular region, for all intents and purposes, there are no foreground objects just because they're. How many you expect. And the background objects, well, they might be there, but they would tend to fall off on this side of the diagram because they'd be seen behind the cloud, and it's a very opaque cloud. But you do tend to start picking them up, and if you want to de-redden them, you kind of have to know the age. But the way the survey's been designed was designed to pick out all things in the surface of the cloud which are young, which formed there. And that's what they look like. This being empty is okay because that's just the sensitivity limit of our survey. I don't know, we see roughly about as many substellar objects as stars. We're picking them out. And we don't see anything here. And I hadn't done one of these before, so it took me a while to appreciate that that's actually quite significant.
The question is, how do you know these are, I mean, they are forming objects, as you say. I mean, if these objects are younger than 36 old, they're very likely still accreting dust or whatever from their cloud. So.
About half of them are.
Yeah, so it's, you know, you cannot call them, I mean, brown dwarfs or stars, right? They are forming brown dwarfs and forming stars, right? So if you want a mass function, it won't be a mass function.
It won't be a mass function. Well, this is where they're forming, okay? And it's everything up to no more than a million years old. And this is what you get. This is about as pure a way of getting a mass function as you can.
Yeah, it's
I mean, disentangling this number and getting a mass for a protostar, okay, is more complicated.
Except that
than
I'm not
for
sure that the static model makes sense at these young ages. You're still accreting mass. And
there are models, okay? There are models. I don't have time to go into them.
You still have the disks. The disks are under radiation. I think you've got to be really careful about using ways.
Sure.
Models.
No, so
such as Adam Burrows.
Sure.
Such as Shushan.
Yeah, sure.
By the way, all right, move on. We got the main point.
If anyone doesn't know who this noisy guy in the front is, Shushan.
I'm stressing that. That's I do not trust our models at these young ages, and.
Clearly, you're all confused now and don't believe a word of this.
The entropy profile of forming objects.
I'm actually not deriving the initial mass function from this data. I'm looking at where these things are to try and figure out how they form and by studying them a bit better. Okay, notice this region is empty. That's not usual. This is Orion. Same diagram, same wavelengths. This region is actually packed full of stuff.
Can you remind us the age of Orion?
1 million years. So it's sort of nominally the same age. Anyway, the fact that this is empty, I mean, I still haven't gone through all the implications of this, but there are a lot of, quote, brown dwarfs down here at low extinction. So to me, simply it says, well, they're either very much, and I don't have time to go into the arguments, but it's pretty straightforward. They're either much older than these objects, so I would say that brown dwarfs formed first in this cloud, or they got to have low extinction some other way, like they were ejected from their binary systems. So this is work that's actively going on. I'm still trying to figure it out, and this is more or less where I am with it. Thank you.
So if they got ejected, they wouldn't be accreting anymore.
That's right.
I have one more question about your last U-graph. I mean, you said that there's like a spread of age between brown dwarfs and the more massive objects. But the spread of age cannot be larger than allowed by the speed of sound over your field of view, right? Roughly speaking. I'm not sure. I mean, information
can. Yes, it can be a larger spread.
So it's going to determine the speed of sound then. It's a thermal sphere, some different from objects faster than transformed by information. It's what puzzles me in these Rayian clusters. Looks like there is a large pair of sound over something like, your field of view is, what, 10 parsecs, something like that?
The field of view is one of those images, 0.7 parsecs. So it's actually quite small. There are a lot of objects in it.
Okay.
So the timing arguments are not really extreme for these regions.
Okay.
It's okay, the speed of sound. So.
Just to follow up, I don't know the answer to this, but with some indication in star forming regions that they go through more than one episode of star formation after starting, maybe four or five. Hints of that sort of thing. So it may not just be one shot, all co-equal.
Well, that would be okay, except then why would you form just brown dwarfs during early phases?
I'm just saying in general.
Uh-huh.
It's related to a condensed matter issue, which may also arise here. In our business, there's a really interesting problem, which is how you understand the deposition of atoms from the vapor on a condensed surface. And the issue is this, that you have objects that are very clearly in scattering states, and they end up in bound states. It happens very quickly. And the question is, how does the energy get shed so quickly? And you have a beam of atoms, for instance, and you end up with a growing film.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets to this point that you sort of skipped over. You call it accretion.
Right.
How does that process happen? Do you involve a third body to carry off the energy, or what happens?
Shocks. You get shocks from the gas flowing. You have a collapse of a cloud.
That's the point. What do you mean by collapse? How does it collapse? Where do you share the energy?
At these densities and temperatures, interstellar gas is very efficient at cooling. So once you start material, the collapse is thought to start because the center becomes unstable. You form some central object. You take away the material, and all of a sudden it loses pressure support below. So there's the next layer. Suddenly has no pressure support and starts to collapse. It's a self-gravitating object.
You have a virial theory, right? So as you start.
The material, you have gas, slams into more gas, heats up, radiates away the energy. Is that answering?
The radiation of the energy is an important part of setting the time scale. By which you mean electromagnetic radiation?
Yeah.
Sigma T to the fourth radiation from the disk as it forms.
Yeah.
It's an important part of determining the dynamical properties and stability of the disk. On this time scale of 1 million years.
And angular momentum also?
Well, you are conserving angular momentum. You may be conserving angular momentum. You
conserve it. You can redistribute it all you want.
In entirety, but I said maybe because, of course, you can also lose material from the system, so it's not a closed system. But if you thought of it as a closed system, you're conserving angular momentum, but you have to dissipate the energy. There is actually, the theory has evolved a lot, but the classic idea in this field is something called the Libin-Bell and Prindle accretion disk model, where you set up a state in which material is redistributed by something that you can think of as a viscosity, and of course that the energy that is created through that viscous flow and redistributed momentum has to be radiated away.
That radiation can escape freely until you get to stellar-like densities. So, yeah.
Remember, you're going through maybe 24 orders of magnitude density. But this problem has been well studied, and everybody has conserved. It's just confusing.
Okay.
talk to the next talk.